to identify.
Okay, so we are recording. This is table three, Gorillums. Just testing the levels. If you guys want to go around and introduce yourselves first and then get started on opening the card, they're here to see what you're asking about.
Are they like playing?
Yeah, so like they have little afros.
I'm Peter Williams, here today at Black Lunch Table.
I'm Christina Molina. I'm an artist living in New Orleans, and I'm a member of The Front, an artist-run gallery on St. Paul.
My name is Lisa Gourmet. I'm a videographer living here in New Orleans.
I'm Francesca Kerner, nicknamed Fran Kerner, and I'm a New Orleans artist, contemporary visual artist.
I'm Melissa Lee. I'm an urban planner here in New Orleans.
And I'm Elizabeth. I am a teacher out here in New Orleans, too.
Should we try the cards?
Mm-hmm. First one.
I'm Peter, and our first question is, how is NOLA unique in regards to activism? Who or what organizations are chief mobilizers? Well, Christina, I think that's in your ballpark.
And it's like owned by like women of color, like, and it's really incredible. Like, there's a lot of like youth, a lot of my students like are involved with like dance shows there, dance collectives there, spoken word there, and it's really incredible, like, to see like how they came up out of, they really have like, did they just move into that space, and within like a few years, like, they have done so much with the community and really focus on like minority populations within the community too, without compromising on like how large they've become.
Right. I find it hard to kind of answer that question because at what point in time do you start identifying how New Orleans has been unique in mobilizing and working with the organizations? Because this is the city that where inequity has always existed.
Mm-hmm.
Disinvestment in the 60s was rampant.
Mm-hmm.
And then folks who stayed, right, had to be pretty much self-sufficient in the face of population decline, city services decline, federal and state monies on the decline, and then the storm happening.
Mm-hmm.
I'm struggling, right? And then it's a city of resilience, right? So
absolutely.
There's organizations, whether you're looking at the pleasure eating social clubs that serve the communities, because this was a segregated South. So you couldn't get insurance, you couldn't be buried properly, you couldn't do all these things because you weren't served or you weren't allowed access to those services. You're looking at the Mardi Gras Indians, who provided an amazing space for art and leadership and community and culture. I don't know, that's a hard question to answer. Tons of nonprofits that are working on behalf of communities and neighborhoods, partnerships with foundations and cities, and I find that a very hard question to answer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I wonder how difficult it is for the people who've been here all these years.
Yeah.
I saw an article in one of the alternative dailies, and they talked about the creatives and the whites taking over the city. And I was surprised by the term creatives and whites taking over the...
When was that written?
This must have been when I first got, the first week I was here.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the name of the daily, but or weekly. But it was one of those alternatives that was looking at the city and the way the... population distribution was changing,
mm-hmm.
and so forth. But that headline stuck out to me as reflective of maybe a general kind of malaise that people have about the kind of changes that are affecting their lives. I taught in Detroit for 20 years.
Oh, okay.
So I have a little bit of a history of living in the inner city and on the east side of Detroit, which is the real inner city. But it was very difficult for projects that I hear about that are going on in New Orleans, where local artists are bringing in young kids to learn photography or to be involved in projects where the parents aren't involved. You know, they feel like their kids somehow in Detroit were going down doing something completely different and new that they weren't invited to join as well. So there was always conflict. We had a project called the Heidelberg Project in Detroit.
Oh, I know that, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Tyree Guyton and his wife, whose name slips to my mind, she's just as important to the project, organized a small neighborhood with sculptures and installations in abandoned homes.
Mm-hmm.
So they might hang empty dresses in a crack house to drive the crackheads away and the spirits away and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Or he might line a street with 10,000 shoes or soles of shoes, and he called it the soles of black folks. So he's done this. But he also had conflict with the city in terms of dealing with how do they handle that project.
Mm-hmm.
As an urban planner, do you find that you get a lot of feedback from people about what's going on in their neighborhoods and such?
All the time. So, there are a lot of forces pushing against each other. So you have the folks who are new to the city, moving in. You have folks who are the indigenous community that have been there for generations, and then trying to find a way to live together. You have home prices, and so we were talking about that earlier. The value of homes are skyrocketing in large pockets of the city, and then others are remaining dormant. And so that's either an opportunity or a disadvantage, depending on if you have resources to move in and to take over 5 homes at $250,000 and flip them.
Oh, wow.
So it's a struggle.
I also heard that people were concerned about the rental situation because tourists coming in Airbnb. For 3 days and leaving. And
what we're finding is that a lot of folks who, for generations, rented, and that was sufficient and that was fine because nobody really wasn't interested in the community or that neighborhood or that home. And so that's how people lived. So there was never this push or education or goal to become homeowners. Mm-hmm. You're working class, so why put that burden on you? And then all of a sudden, folks are now coming back into the city who necessarily are from here. So I'm part of that myself. And so renters are getting pushed out, so moving out to the east.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why the east?
Because that's the up and coming area where neighborhoods here are more like Treme, where we're sitting, is very desirable.
Mm-hmm.
And I can speak to the east, like working there. Like it is absolutely not only a food desert, but a food swamp. All you have out there is a Popeyes and a Winn-Dixie next to my school, and like those are the primary like sources of food for not only the teachers but also the students. Like, and also I know a lot of my students face like heightened crime after being pushed out from like New Orleans proper into the east because you have. These students are so proud of their neighborhoods, right? And then everyone pushed out to the east where, like, after the storm, they didn't even want to turn the water and the lights back on. They were going to leave New Orleans East without any electricity until it took, honestly, outsiders, unfortunately, to come in and, like, force them to put the energy back on in the east. Like, the roads are falling, like, apart. You know, it's horrible. And, like, now you have these kids who used to be different neighborhoods coming in together. And we have a heightened violence because, like, everyone's being forced into these new neighborhoods. It's literally like planned black genocide, and it's just really unfortunate to see the ways in which my school is treated out in the east versus schools within the same charter network uptown, and the resources that are given to them, the amount of like support. Like, no one ever comes to my school to like check in on my students, but uptown, like all the schools, you know, on Magazine, they got people every day. You know, and it's really unfortunate, especially when you think of activism and who has, like, access to that activism, who can afford to get across the water, who has transportation provided for them. It's really, like, heartbreaking sometimes, like, the lack of access my students have because of this, like, them being forced out.
Right. And then you have neighborhoods like Treme, for example, that's so historic, so amazing, the first black neighborhood in the country to be founded, birthplace of jazz. It's why it makes New Orleans so unique and why people want to come here. But then you build your home here and you're like, it's too noisy. I hear music 24/7.
You
came
musicians
to New Orleans. Are playing down the street. So let's create a noise ordinance. So stop that.
Yeah.
So then it's multi-layered.
So how do you reconcile racism with progress? How do you recognize gentrification versus development? I mean, those must be, you live in the neighborhood. Do you, have thoughts about those kinds of enterprises and how they're affecting your neighborhood?
I want to have one less gourmet.
Yeah. reality. That's the reality you're working in.
Because I might get lucky, because I've gotten lucky in the past, but I just feel like for that to be the structure that I'm going to be operating in, it's just like, I don't know, it just feels really unsustainable.
Privatization of public education, literacy rates, and access to college education.
Oh, Lord.
That's a big one.
Should we start with this now, this new wave of trying to deprivatize schools and return them? I don't know.
I think that's something that the privatization of public education is a difficult question to answer, because the public education is so much. My biggest shock in Detroit was that 60% of high school graduates weren't graduating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd never heard of such a thing. And it seems to me that somehow we've got to take back the education system. I see it at the university level, and it's not just poor black people, but young white kids as well are unprepared to have a regular education. You sort of find that the other world that's coming over to the university system from other countries are more invigorated, more asset-driven, and more able to adapt in some ways, but for the isms that are against them in some ways.
Yeah.
And that's something that, you know, I think as we become a less literate place to live, is going to be more and more impacting everyone and the kinds of things that we need to do to provide.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you have these charter schools, which, I don't know, it's like a return to, you know, some kind of authoritarian figure.
Absolutely.
Kind of thing. Is there a place in between all that?
Well, by 2000, the New Orleans public school system started divesting in schools because the population decrease was such that it was under, I want to say, 300,000 people, and so you have these beautiful, large, historic schools, but there weren't enough kids to fill them, so I started disinvesting, and then the storm happened. And so then, as a result, the recovery school system came in to take over the New Orleans public school system. And then that recovery system turned it over to the charter school. Mm-hmm. So all these charter schools came in to take over and to...
Build. Ostensibly, right?
So then you have the charter schools, and then you have private schools. So like the private all-girls schools, all-boys schools, the Catholic schools, and you have all these charter schools.
And it's fascinating because all of the principals of all the charter schools send their kids to the private schools. Mm-hmm. So my principal's students would never touch my school. Yeah. Never. My school, I would cry if my child went there. And that's so heartbreaking to say when I teach there. Like, I have the charter network, like so many parts of my like school are formed after prisons. Like, they just like model directly after prisons. Like the black lines that we walk on so that we can, because as eighth graders, and I know you're an eighth grader who's been held back 3 times, so you're actually 16 in the eighth grade, and you're still walking on black lines, and you still have to be pin drop silent while you're in the school. We still have alternative like behavioral programs, which means you're in a room all day looking at like a coach, and someone is going in to teach you apparently, but I never see anyone going in and out of that room. We still wear like 35 high, where most of my kids go to afterwards, has a holding cell in the school for behavioral, like it's obscene, and the violence, like I've seen multiple, like 2 schools in the past year have been shut down because there's been like actual physical violence against children. Like this, the amount of violence that I have seen inside these schools, and then couple that with like uncertified teachers, couple that with, and I'll be completely honest, I am a TFA, I'm a Teach for America, and like couple that with unprepared teachers. Like I have such issues with the organization that I chose to join, and it's an organization that was built for young white saviors to come in and teach these students who have no understanding of their background, and then even then as a ill-prepared, and then even as a black woman who had the access to a college education, still is very culturally disparate from my students, and not seeing enough like representation. Like most of the schools are white run, white teachers, white. It's absurd, and because they're privatized, I don't have a principal. I have a principal, but above her is a CEO. We have CEOs. Like not principals and everything, and we take tests because we take tests every week for 2 hours because then test companies make money off of like our students taking these tests, and we have enough money to pay for those tests. We don't have enough money. I've had one book I've been teaching for 9 months, six, 7 months now, and I only have had one book that I've taught from. Yeah, so we use paper for my worksheets, but oftentimes we don't have enough money to buy paper. But I have enough money to buy this test that tortures my students every 2 weeks and now makes them hate English. Like, I cannot tell you how much my kids hate to read because I'm not allowed to teach them texts that reflect who they look like.
So you're not introducing them to Toni Morrison, for example.
I tried one day, but because of the ways in which, I think my students always complain, like, Ms. Smith, I feel like a prisoner, because they're aware that this is not the way school is supposed to be, which is why I think fascinating when they've grown up in the system their entire lives. But they're aware that this is not the way school is supposed to be, but it's so hard because I can't change it, because in many ways I feel like a prisoner too, because we are so monitored. The one day I brought in Baldwin, I had 4 white people in my classroom the next day, all monitoring, looking at what I was doing. Like, heaven forbid the Negro, like, stop being so docile, you know? Heaven forbid, like, we teach something that looks like our students. Like, the monitoring that I've seen that's allowed to happen because we are privatized isn't... Ooh, I could go on for hours, so I'm going to stop.
I have a strange question. Fran, how do you feel about hearing all of this, reflecting on, you know, the dominant culture, whiteness and so forth, playing a significant role or an underpinning of that? Or can you step aside and not engage? And if you don't want to answer, it's okay.
My mother came from Wales. Her family was all from, my mother's from Wales. She's Welsh, that's Europe. So when she came over to New Orleans, she was ostracized as well. Mm-hmm. So I can kind of kind of relate.
Okay.
I went to a private school and I hated it so much that I never finished high school.
Oh.
Yeah, I quit. I quit high school and, but then I was able to graduate from Tulane University with, you know, a degree and then get a graduate degree as well. It's really confusing. I feel powerless. You know, I'm really curious to hear. I have three sons, and I sent them to a private school so that they could get a good foundation when they were young, and then I sent them to a public school because I wanted them to have a real upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
And they got a good education, though. That was it.
That's the difference.
Well, that was the education that you, yeah. Well, they had a good public school education. I don't know why I can't think of her name. Ben Franklin.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They
tested to get in. So,
yeah.
But I'm really frustrated by what's going on, and I've been trying to understand, like, the charter schools, whether that, you know, I mean, at first I said, well, that's really a good thing, but, you know, I hear it's not. It's more about up on the talks at Tulane about it. It's more about making money.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and like you said, Teach for America, the white warriors to come in and say,
yeah.
Because a lot of those kids, they don't know what the culture's like, and they don't know how to teach, and they're young, and I heard that the schools got rid of the teachers who had been there a long time, so that they didn't have to pay them as much money. So, but I, you know, I'm like a believer in education as being one of the best things that can help people.
Absolutely.
And I've traveled to Europe a lot. I have a lot of European friends, and I see that they're much better prepared. And you know, I'm always going to Europeans wherever I go. Like, I end up being friends with them just because, I don't know. But when I was in school at UNO and there were a lot of Europeans, they had a much better education. And it's frustrating because I think that's the way out of poverty, is to have a good education. Oh, and I'm really angry at Bobby Jindal, our governor, who took money from the public schools to give it to certain kids to go to private schools. I mean, that just didn't make any sense to me at all. I mean, why not put that money, like, directly into the public schools? So, I don't know. It's actually something I think about a lot. And I don't know what to do. You know? So
is there much discussion amongst your peer group?
Well, it's always it's something I always pick up. My mother used to volunteer and read at the public schools. You know, I mean, it's just something that I grew up with, trying to make things better.
Sure.
I don't know if I ever have a chance. I'm the one who says, you know, we need to get the public schools better because that's
the future.
And then also, like, better jobs in the city other than the service industry. I mean, that's also frustrating. I'm personally very frustrated with New Orleans. But, you know.
Well, it's interesting to hear. As an outsider, because, I mean, my experience is I was in grad school in Baltimore during the height of the crack epidemic, and Detroit during that epidemic that went on. I left just as the resurgence was beginning its possibilities. Then it crashed, and now it's starting to, but it's all becoming gentrified, and the neighborhoods are really still in disrepair and disarray to a large degree in there. And I found myself, it was too threatening to stay in the city as a handicapped person. People knew my name and would ask me for money because I lived in the neighborhood in the big house, and it was the only neighborhood I could afford to move into. And the big houses were going for dirt cheap. But it scared me. You know, what was going to become of the city. And I think that's one thing that made me realize I couldn't move to the suburbs, because that would just have been, can't do that, too shameful. So I decided to go and explore what life on a white planet was like by going to Delaware.
Dull and unaware.
Dull unaware. and it's been good in some ways, because it's forced me to focus on the conditions of race and identity, and I incorporate that into my artwork that I do. I try to deal with narrative imagery and painting, autobiography and portraiture as a condition in the work itself. Do you find that it reflect any of these conditions reflect in the kind of work that you do?
I get after Katrina, I had an idea to fill a house that had been flooded and gutted with handfuls of paper boats, and so I collaborated with two women from graduate school, and we did the Apostolic Project, which was in the Lower Ninth Ward, and we invited the neighbors and we went to the churches and asked people if they wanted to help us, paper boats to put in there, just like bring the, idea was to bring the community together because we were so bereft after Katrina, and so that's one thing I've done.
I don't think it's, I haven't been here long enough to really go with that experience yet, but I do feel like on the flip side, there's a lot of momentum and energy to, keep supporting new projects and keep supporting, positive aspects of change that are happening. Lay the foundation.
Right.
We move into an area that's cheap, that we can afford, and then make it, not to conflate the role of the artist or glamorize it, but it's true that people are attracted to, projects where things are, become aesthetic, and, our programming is free and open to the public, and so it attracts attention, and now suddenly, Solange wants to buy a house,
culture is a very scary thing.
Yeah.
Because I remember the first time I went into a museum, everybody was whispering. And I thought I was back in church again.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure I was permitted to really look at or touch or whatever. But I think the one thing I saw in Detroit was you really got to reach out to kids and get them to grow up in a milieu where there's a possibility of exchange of information and experiences and such. But should we try another one?
Sure. Quick question. Do you have any relationship with the Axiom Art Gallery, Art Collective on Ferret?
No, I've heard of them.
They do incredible work. I think they would be, and they're on Ferret and they do incredible outreach work, and I think they've done an amazing job of because Ferret is the most gentrified spot right now in the world. And they've done amazing work in terms of really keeping it still very community centric. I think that'd be an awesome place.
It's
that's good to know. That's yeah. Part of my neighborhood.
Oh, for sure. That's where yeah. we stay too. And, yeah.
You know what? I think I should pass the deck around.
Okay.
That way everyone can take a look at what might be the next discussion. I'll get some more juice here.
I'll pick two, so we can pick one. I'll pick three, so we can pick one. all right, so we have, so we have Mardi Gras crews are historically race, gender, and class specific. Discuss this and other forms of self-segregation that exist today, or food and desserts, or social aid and pleasure clubs, baby dolls, skull and bone gangs, and the Mardi Gras Indians are a visible manifestation of this city's history. Discuss the private and public culture. Do you have a preference?
Oh, wow.
I do enjoy the first one, because I saw some really racist, just flat-out racist Mardi Gras floats this year.
Oh, really?
Extraordinarily and sexist, and classist, and
In what form did they?
In Crew of Tux. We just happened to stop by it, and it was like Tux goes to the hood. And it was all of these white people, and I don't think I saw any blackface, but it was always white people, and I don't know, it was blackface, with curly fro, with curly wigs, and traditionally like African-American like associated clothing, all running around drunk. And it just was really uncomfortable. And then there was another parade, actually, another one at Muses, where it was Hillary Clinton being a puppet of Bill Clinton. And like, that was intentionally made very recently happen, you know? It's not like we have sexism, racism, like, and who's on these floats? Traditionally white men, you know, and sometimes white women. And it was just, it was fascinating. I don't know, did anyone else notice that? It was my first Mardi Gras, so.
I hate Mardi Gras. Yeah. I don't go unless I have people coming in from out of town.
Okay. Yeah,
because of all of that.
Yeah. I have a love-hate relationship with Mardi Gras.
Yeah.
You know. I think, you know, for a long time, so the first Mardi Gras, I think, was in the 1700s, and it was this particularly wealthy white family who would, it's, I guess, a French tradition, they would throw coins and bread out to the masses.
Mm. Oh!
And they, and that was a kind of the first Mardi Gras. And there needed to be someone to light the way, so enslaved Africans would carry, you know, torches.
Oh, the flambeaux.
And that was the tradition of the flambeaux.
Okay.
And then over time, these crews developed, and they're the wealthy, you know, old school white families who basically that's how they connect socially, politically, culturally. These crews started, and I think in about 1910. And they were all obviously segregated all white. That 1910 Zulu formed. Mm-hmm. And Zulu was basically the kind of the to all of these.
Yeah.
You know, basically, we want to have our own crew. We want to participate. And so it was like, okay, we're going to be the caricatures of how you portray us every day.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to do it in a way that we can afford. So, okay, there's some dirt here. We'll make ourselves even blacker and do blackface.
We're
going
to throw coconuts.
And, you know, that's what we could do. So that's how Zulu formed. And ever since then, that they were these two separate crews that rolled during Mardi Gras. And then in about 1980s, the city council said, it's ridiculous. We need to be integrated.
Mm.
So I think in the 80s or 90s, they...
Yeah, I can't remember.
Yeah, they had some ordinances where...
Prospect recently did an incident or a performance about that at the museum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that in the late 80s, city council said, no more, you can no longer be segregated as Mardi Gras crews. So some of the crews still exist, but they stopped writing.
They refused to integrate because of that. Yeah.
They refused to integrate. So the only ones that really do are Rex. And there's only two black people. I don't think any Latinos, I don't think any Asians.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's some other, then there's, then particularly after the storm, other crews started.
Mm-hmm.
So and then you had all women that started either after the storm. So they're integrated enough where you have one or two representatives, mm-hmm. and then Zulu has, they'll allow anyone to ride. So, but with that comes a lot of tradition. You're talking centuries of tradition. So it's really hard to negotiate that. And the rule for all crews are that you have to be masked. You're a identity has to be masked in some way. So that's why you have some folks wearing, you know, white masks, other folks wearing blackface, other folks wearing. So it's a centuries of tradition. So people love tradition, the good, bad, and ugly of it. So I think for us as outsiders, it's such a it's a startling experience because you're like, this is so blatant and clear, and what the heck?
Absolutely.
But it's, you know, and from that a lot of it's hard to negotiate.
Yeah, no.
So people just say it's tradition.
Well, in New Orleans, it's supposedly if they're big into tradition and history, and you have to be here for 150 years before you're really like accepted.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's weird because my family, I'm from an uptown family, and we weren't accepted for a long time, 150 years, and then. Actually, my costume was pink wraps, you know, which was like, wow. I mean, I was shocked because I always felt kind of welcome. But after 150 years, it changed. And so that's just.
Most New Orleanians, the average New Orleanians can trace their family in New Orleans back 7 to 8 generations.
Wow.
Yeah, and
so that's what we're talking about in history.
Right.
7 to 8 generations in this city.
And I always feel
black or white.
Lucky because mother was from Wales, so like it broke that. You know, otherwise I don't know who I'd be. You know, so I got like a less provincial experience and perspective. You know,
Well, it's interesting that there's so much racial mixing in the history of the city, yet there isn't. A greater cohesiveness amongst different groups, and I don't know if that plays whether you're light-skinned or dark-skinned or white-skinned.
That's a whole other monster.
Yeah, like the Creole population.
That's a big monster.
That's a whole other.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, I always try to have more, you know, like being more. I mean, I really do. I really try to have more friends who are black. You know, and I really try, but it's got to be a two-way street, you know.
How so? Do you find people are not reflecting your invitation?
I reach out to people and say, let's get together, let's have coffee, whatever, and I would like to have it happen more. I mean, really, you know, that's me.
Yeah. Well,
but I think it's on both sides.
I mean, there's this strange sense of comfortability that comes with knowing somebody's family history for 150 years.
Oh,
knowing every single family member, cousins, second aunts removed. Oh, I remember you lived on this street. I can name the ad. There's this comfortability that, you know, a lot of us don't represent. So that's
absolutely.
Like...
It allows you a guideline.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's hard.
I would imagine so, especially moving here means that you don't have the connections that can make to find the kind of affordable things that you need to a large degree.
Mm-hmm. And then and vice versa, you know, you're kind of kept at bay, right? Because you don't have that history. So then we form our own. Support groups, and so there's
well, even within the culture, because I know when I lived in Detroit, I was the outsider, and even amongst the community, I was the outsider, and because I taught at a university, I was doubly the outsider, and then it was a majority white university, I was triply the outsider. Everything I seemed to be was constantly causing conflict within even the way I spoke. Created a kind of conflict, you know, that as I became aware of my history, meaning that I had a more subtle history with whites than I did with blacks, to a large degree because of my education, and it reflected also my upbringing, the way I grew up in a kind of first generation, second generation immigrants who were white, and there wasn't the kind of racial division amongst us as kids. But going to Detroit, I finally settled into a place where I had to deal with my place being kind of called into question because of what I didn't represent. I didn't have seven generations in the same city and so forth. That made it extremely difficult.
I think it's just so, especially in New Orleans, like I'm never going to fault anybody who has lived here for years and years and years for not wanting me here. I'm never going to fault you because you know what, when you see your like when you're kicked out of your homes, when you see your neighborhoods changing, you know, when you see these resources that were meant for you being used by me, I'm not going to fault you for being mad at me. But like, and I think it's just so fascinating and a conversation that's not being had. And in so many terms of gentrification is like, there are people of color who are gentrifiers, like, you know? And like, I think sometimes gentrification, like, is termed as like a white person, like, doing this, and like, it's so much more nuanced when like, yes, I'm from California, but my family's from Baton Rouge, and originally from New Orleans, but like, what does it mean that I still had all this privilege given to me on the West Coast, and now I come back trying to help your children, you know? At schools that I would not send my child to, you know? I think it's just so nuanced, and so I'm never gonna be mad at my co-teacher who hated me for the first, like, for probably the first 4 months of our working relationship because she's born and raised Gentilly. Born and raised, and then she hears a fast-talking, like, California girl come in and hates me, absolutely hates me, and we're good now, but...
That's part of the course.
It is, you know, and you're right, and, like, it is so hard to not just go into, like, our little niche communities of, like, newcomers. It's so difficult, you know? It's so, especially because New Orleans is a different place. It is different, unique. Absolutely.
People can organically meet each other. You know, it is a little bit weird to be like, you're different from me. You're a friend. You know, like,
right,
it's,
yeah,
it's,
yeah,
not like that. That kind of sets off the,
yeah,
vibe a little bit. Like, yeah. I think like, it seems like almost like a exoticizing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, like,
absolutely.
Where you're in a position where you want diversity, but you. Wanted so much that it becomes like another kind of fetish.
Mm-hmm.
And like, we talk a lot about that at the front because, like, up until my membership cycle, there wasn't, like, everybody was like in their 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And like, then when my group came in, then we did have an artist who's African American, myself who's Latino, and now we have another artist who's of African descent, not African American, but she's from Algiers. You know,
okay.
Like, so we have like, but it had to happen. Like, there was no way for us to be like it wasn't like affirmative action, and we didn't feel right about that. Like,
absolutely.
That community wasn't like, oh, we're just gonna pick them because we want diversity. Like, they had to be a good artist, and like, also, you know, part of another. And like, those conversations are really difficult because I think to just like pick someone because they're different contributes. The problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
absolutely.
Like,
tokenizing.
Yeah. So I think this is like a healthy way where you just like bring people from the community together. Like, let's just talk about it directly and see like, mm-hmm, if there's like natural chemistry,
mm-hmm,
you know, between these people. If like, you know, we have the same interests, even, you know, we can at least like share like a common concern or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It was really telling for me. I belong to a book club. We're about, I don't know, 25 women deep.
What's it called?
It's the Drinking and Reading Society.
Very cool. I just wanted to know. Sorry.
Cool. It's about 25 women. And my friend was hosting the meeting. And so I said, I'll come early to help you set up.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked in the door, and there was a woman there I had never seen before. So I said, oh, hi, my name's Melissa. What's your name? So I gave her a hug. I said, welcome to the book club. And one by one, as they walked in, we did that with her because we hadn't seen her before. And before you knew it, we were about 20 deep. We had gotten our food and drink, and we had started, you know, talking about the book and having a great time. And the whole time she was kind of quiet. She just kind of, very nice, but kind of just sat there, kind of quiet. And so then she was like, I have to say, at the end, just have to say something. She goes, this is the first time, I think, ever in my life in New Orleans, I've walked into a room and I have not known more than one person. I've not known anybody, actually, because her friend hadn't come yet. Her friend that invited her, I'm sorry, hadn't come yet. Because where I've walked into a room in New Orleans and I've never not known anybody.
Mm.
And I'm a little freaked out.
Wow.
She goes,
that's fascinating.
And she goes, you guys are all lovely, and I'm so happy to meet you, and I'm so, like, I'm so curious by who you are. I'm curious by each of you are. I'm curious by this group. This is exciting, but I'm freaked out because I've never knocked and walked into a room and not known anybody in New Orleans ever. And is this setting the tone for what life is going to be like? Is this the way things are? Is this what's going to happen when I walk into my neighborhood establishment or my work or my school or what have you? She goes, this is a little scary, but also exciting. So I think she was like, she goes, and I've taken that for granted, because I could walk anywhere down the street in a room, my doctor's office, and know everybody. And this is the first time I've not known anybody ever in my life. Is this my new New Orleans?
Right. Wow.
I can speak to that. See, I like that, being in New Orleans. I actually embrace the new people coming in, because I think it's going to help shake it up.
Yeah. She liked it, but it was very scary for her.
Yeah.
She was like, ooh, okay. Let me gear up and brace for this, because it is probably going to shake things up. So she was like, wow. It kind of shook her.
Does that speak to the history of the city more than other cities?
Yeah, you go back 7-8 generations, you know everybody. That's how you operate. That's how things got done. That's how you get supported. That's
partly because of the segregation, do you think? I mean, build constituencies?
No. I don't think so.
I think it's just the way?
I think, because it's across the cultures.
Oh.
Yeah. I think it's across the cultures.
Moving here, that was the first thing I noticed is that I've never been anywhere in the United States where I felt so like there was so people were so close.
Absolutely.
And wanted to be together, like in community. You know, like people go out to like hang out, they plan events, like social things, to just shoot the shit. You know, just but they like to be together.
Like they've known each other for maybe a year, but like cousin. My co-teacher is every student's mom. Like everyone just calls her mom, you know. And like it was just even in the dialect, like you could just hear like this family of kids who had just met each other all of a sudden now being cousins and brothers. Like it was, I've never seen that. And like back to that first question of like what makes New Orleans unique, and in terms of like paying your dues, like it took so long for a teacher to even call me like maybe call me mom, and I was like nah, I'm like not that much older than you, know. But I was like I'll be auntie. Like, but it really did take so long to even sort of come close to that. And even then, I still haven't paid due, you know? Like, you can tell it's such a big difference. And that's such, like, that's so insightful what you said about, like, people just coming in and penetrating that, like that being, that is so alluring. Cause like so many different cities are so fragmented now. And that hasn't happened, you know, within like these small, they're holding on so tight.
But I think looping back to that question, I think that's why that self-segregation still exists, is because of that sense of culture and history that goes back a century.
Mm-hmm.
Right, to the Spanish and French origins, and the Africans coming in at that time, that far back.
Mm-hmm. And tradition and culture and history are very important.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as well as tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that tradition's kind of... You say it right with me, so it's tradition. Get over it, Melissa. It's tradition.
Where are you from?
It's racist.
Pasadena, California.
Pasadena.
Y'all are both from California?
Yeah. Northern and Southern. But
I always want to move to California.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Is the concept of black Indians racist? Is masking Zulu racist? Why or why not? I don't know anything about black Indians other than black Indians. But is that...
I don't know how you would consider that racist.
It's not racist at all. No, it's like, it really, like, black Indians became black Indians because they're giving honor to, like, the Seminole Native Americans who took in African-American enslaved people. And, like, there's been a long-term, like, amazing historical alliance between these two groups of people. And I think that, especially also because it's African-Americans doing so, and we think about, like, the spectrums of levels of oppression, like, indigenous people are definitely, like, with theirs. But I think, like, this is much more of a celebration of solidarity rather than, like, African-Americans appropriating Native culture, because it was made in conjunction, and it's a celebration of, like, mutual, like, helping each other out. So no, in my personal opinion, no, but I don't know, maybe other people disagree.
I think they form families.
Yes.
From that, like you said, amazing community was formed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we agree on this one.
It seems like so much of what goes on here, you really have to know 7 or 8 generations worth of history.
Yes, you do.
So in order to negotiate through the community and
right.
such.
What do you
and,
think,
Ron? I don't know that I agree with that.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just interesting to hear your perspective.
Well, just from what I'm hearing,
yeah,
because I haven't been here long enough to really know.
I don't know, maybe you're overemphasizing the, 150 years. I mean, I was just throwing that out, but I don't know. Yeah.
I don't know. You know, I've been reading American Uprising, mm-hmm. the revolt of 1811,
mm-hmm.
and the history, the backstory to that, that goes to the Louisiana Purchase
mm-hmm.
and the Haitian uprising and how all of that affected New Orleans and its development with sugar plantations and so forth. But it seems to me that along the way, this idea of families being constructed in the swamps and so forth, that they could be black, white, native people, etc., seems somewhat authentic. In that struggle, and that once you begin to co-opt, your situation and try to bring together a kind of formal, since slaves rarely married because of you're going to be sold at some point. The relationships had to be somewhat institutional in a way that was workable, and that one would have to know that over the many, many decades or years that they were dealing with slavery and so forth, to know that history and to be able to communicate with one another without the fear of being sent to the overseer to deal with these kinds of things. So I guess that's why I'm kind of curious about what I'm reading versus what I'm hearing, you know, about how we negotiate our lives through all of this. You know, I feel uncomfortable talking at times about whiteness, but I do that back in my town or city that I teach in and so forth, and at my university, not to be provocative, sometimes to be provocative.
To be provocative.
But also to satisfy my need to be engaged, you know, in a dialogue, questioning authority a bit, since mine is often questioned as well.
Absolutely.
And I feel that institutional pressure that comes from the kind of management of education and so forth, that we've got to have some pushback as well. And this circle may lead me to certain cultural differences and so forth that may exist, you know, in doing some of that. So, I mean, I think some of this is kind of interesting about the masks that we all wear in order to sort of get through or negotiate our situations.
In general.
Every day.
Every day.
Right.
Hey, we touched on this, like the second question.
Yeah.
My vision that it was, it's making racist.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's
called.
Yeah.
But I mean, it started as a parody.
Yeah.
Like, it was a crew that formed, again, because there weren't these systems in place for African-American communities to participate in crews. So they said, like, well, with it, we're going to form our own crew and we're going to, like, make a parody of what happened.
So why is masking being brought up in, as
because
a question?
They, in the beginning when they formed, they actually wore blackface.
Oh.
And they do now.
Yeah.
They like do now?
Black I voted face. Zulu. Yeah.
Oh, you did?
You got blackface.
Oh, did you? Yeah. Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But it's from the position of being critical. You know, that's how it started at the end. So I don't know if the people, I mean, I'm pretty sure that they still have a connection to that criticality. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Absolutely. So, I mean, the rules were if you were going to ride in it, if you rode in Mardi Gras, you had to be masked.
Mm-hmm.
You had to have some sort of mask.
Why? What? Do you know why that was?
Why?
Do you know why they have to be masked?
Because it's a sense of mystery, ambiguity.
Oh, okay.
You're protecting who your members of your crew are.
Oh,
it's a secret
okay.
society.
Secret society. Gotcha. Exclusivity.
Right.
Exclusivity.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's the rule. So then the thing was, how are we going to mask ourselves? They don't have a lot of resources.
Mm.
We're trying to form this, and they hate us. Let's just spell it out.
And then that's fascinating. Right?
So now we're masked. So we check that requirement, and we're being critical.
All right.
And we're making a statement.
How many years have you been here?
Four.
You really learned.
Yeah, I was like, you are like knowledgeable. I learned a lot.
Okay.
There's so many questions.
Yeah. Right.
Did you make this deck, or where did it come out? It's beautiful. It's really well made. It's really well made. This would be interesting in terms of Beyonce's new video, Formation, Black New Orleanians.
Maybe the question.
Okay, so discuss media representations of Black New Orleanians. I thought of Beyonce's video that just dropped, Formation.
You left it.
What did you think about it?
I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
However, I'm trying to figure out her true perspective for doing it.
Absolutely.
I was so shocked, like, appalled by some of the scenes, like, her, like, floating off this cop car, glamorously, like, that scene.
scene. That's trauma, like, inducing, like, very triggering scene.
Yeah, I think that, you know, like, I'm sure that her intentions and, like, the language that she's using is supposed to be, like, empowering, but I also think it's, like, aestheticizing somebody else's tragedy for your benefit, you know, and for the sake of your own collaborator.
Right. And then why did you choose to bring in Messy Maya and Big Frida into that? I don't know. We have to ask her.
And also, why is she not coming to New Orleans on the tour that she named after her video that made money off of this tragedy? The Formation tour literally flies over us. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I think like she was trying to outline a lot of issues, which is positive. You know, like of course, like bring attention to these issues that are unjust or whatever. But she's like still participating in the language of oppression.
Right, so it's like cliche and passé at the same time, but beautifully done.
But are we surprised?
You're surprised.
She's a capitalist. She's a capitalist.
That's being rhetorical.
You have to make it clear for the audio recording.
Rhetorical.
Absolutely.
And let's be clear, half of her video was filmed in Pasadena, California.
Really, was it? No, it wasn't.
Well, they said that, like, she wasn't in New Orleans. She was in
Pasadena.
Like, a lot of the imagery was
cut from a documentary. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, a documentary on bounce music, which like is I guess ties in Big Frida a little bit more. But my co-teacher, born and raised in New Orleans, was like, why would you choose like Messy Maya, who is a professional shit talker, and of course a part of this community and like a testament to the violence in New Orleans, but like, and Big Frida, queer, presenting bounce artist, amazing person. But there are also just other representations you could have chosen. We have incredible families doing incredible things. You could have chosen more understandably, like readably to like the average person, positive representations of New Orleans. You know, like why are you only showing the hood and people being shot? And you know, it's just that was her. This is her speaking through me, but that was her personal perspective on it.
Yeah.
And
what does that mean?
Tragedy.
And mm-hmm.
Right. I don't know, just to like, it seems like sacrilegious, you know, to put like a rhythm to like, it's like, put it, it's like if I made a song and then I chose like footage of Katrina and like put like this really like fun song to the footage of Katrina, like,